Hey, this episode of The Majority Report is brought to you by SunsetLakeSabade.com. And Sunset Lake has decided for this Black Friday, they're going to do something really different. Sunset Lake Sabade and The Majority Report are teaming up to turn America's most consumerist holiday into a fundraising opportunity for a great organization, and here's how it works. You visit SunsetLakeSabade.com, and starting November 22nd, all Sabade products are going to be between, you ready for this, 30 and 60% off. That means right now, folks, as soon as you hear this, they are available. Orders over 100 are going to receive a free jar of delicious Sabade gummies, a $40 value for free. You do not need a promo code for these products. They are already discounted on the website. So check it out. This is a great company. They have been a great sponsor of this program. But beyond that, they have they're a movement partner, and their products have an incredible amount of integrity. You can see all of the third-party analysis of what's in there. They have great farming practices, great business practices, and they allow me to get much better sleep because of their tinctures. So in this sale, Sunset Lake Sabade will donate 10% of their sales to givedirectly.org. It's an international anti-poverty organization that sends cash directly to people so they can choose for themselves how to spend the money with dignity in a way that best suits their needs and their lives. You've heard me talk about Give Directly in the past. It's one of my favorite charities, just because there's a lot of data that shows if you give people living in extreme poverty money directly, they know how to spend it the best. And Sunset Lake came to us and said, we want to do this thing. And what charity should we choose? And so here's the deal. We at The Majority Report are going to match that 10% donation. So if folks buy $100,000 worth of Sunset Lake Sabade product over the next couple until December 1st, they're going to give 10 grand, and we're going to give 10 grand to givedirectly.org. Sunset Lake Sabade is a majority employee-owned business. They have donated more than $16,000 this year to anti-drug war organizations, to animal shelters, union strike funds. We talked about the nurses up in Worcester, nature conservation, food shelves, and refugee resettlement organizations. Again, visit SunsetLakeSabade.com to take advantage of these huge discounts and help Majority Report raise money for a great organization. Sale ends December 1st. Now, for the show. Ready? Monday, November 22nd, 2021. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Dr. William Blair, professor, Penn State University, on the record of murders and outrages, racial evidence in the fight over truth at the dawn of Reconstruction. Also on the program today, Joe Biden renames Jerome Powell to chair the Fed in a sop to inflation hawks. 5 dead and 40 injured after SUV drives into a crowd in Wisconsin. Texas abortion ban could be ruled upon any day now. And the U.S. makes it to a list of backsliding democracies for the first time. Meanwhile, leaked texts from January 6 organizers follow the president's lead. Protests in Europe as COVID suggests or surges and lockdowns return. U.S. COVID deaths top 770,000, with more than half coming in 2021. Lastly, Georgia Senate approves a gerrymandered map giving the Republicans 64% seats in a state Biden won with 49.5% of the vote. Yeah, is the audio is sounding weird, apparently, guys. We're having a little bit of technical problems. Okay, are we back? All right, we're having a little bit of technical problems. Just to let you know what's going on. One of my kids was exposed to COVID at school, and so they can't go back to school. So I am trying to figure out, I'm working how to both, you know, protect my child, who I think is fine. We've taken a couple of at-home tests and also take care of the children and also not expose anybody in this office in the event that somehow I got exposed from my son. So nobody's in the office. We're doing this sort of remote again. Just so you know, there's a chance that maybe tomorrow Emma will be here solo because of that, because I, you know, welcome to it. I mean, I am boosted. Others are boosted here, but the real issue is that everybody's going away for Thanksgiving, and we don't want to somehow, you know, we're doing the 1% doctrine here. Very low risk, I think, for anybody to be catching it, but the implications could be pretty nasty when we're talking about people going home to see their elder parents, et cetera, including mine. And so in an abundance of caution, that's what's going on here. So things are a little bit tricky on our end. Don't worry. We will get to it. We've got a couple of things, clips I want to play here. So the Kyle Rittenhouse fallout is happening. He was, as you know, found not guilty of all charges in his trial. Just to reiterate, I don't generally get too involved in criminal trials, just as a matter of policy. I've never done it, have really very little interest in doing that. It's quite possible the law is such that there is no accountability for somebody who decides to pick up a gun and go unilaterally decide that they're going to be policing a protest, and it ends up in people getting shot to death. And he killed them. He didn't murder them because that's a legal term, but he did kill two people. And when we talk about the idea of it being politicized, the right is freaking out apparently because people are upset about this hearing, or I should say this verdict. Let's see what it means to politicize a guy who has killed two people, right? I mean, at the very least, it's a tragedy that everybody would want to move on from if you felt that Kyle Rittenhouse was, I guess, innocent or not guilty, however you want to pose that. But no, Kyle Rittenhouse, this guy has like basically won the right-wing lottery. He will be a star in that world for what? For killing two people and shooting a third. I guess presumably because it was a protest. But here it is.
Our documentary team was there in Kenosha when it happened. They've been there for days putting together an installment of our Tucker Carlson original series on this case. And they captured Kyle Rittenhouse's first moments outside the court today after being acquitted.
It's the stuff that keeps you up at night. Like, once you finally do get to sleep, your dreams are about what happened and you're waking up in a dark, cold sweat.
Yeah. You've had dreams about what happened?
Every single night. It's quite scary, actually, because the dreams feel so real, and they're not the same at all. They're all different. They're the different scenarios that run through your head during the day, like what could have happened. Like, I'm alive, but what could have happened? Like, what if I wasn't alive, or what if I did let Mr. Rosenbaum steal my gun? It's those type of dreams of outcome of it's bad, but almost every outcome is either me getting seriously injured or hurt or dead. Those are just the dreams I have on a daily basis.
The defendant will rise, face the jury, and hearken to its verdicts.
Data Wisconsin versus Kyle Rittenhouse. As to the first count of the information, Joseph Rosenbaum, we the jury find the defendant Kyle H. Rittenhouse not guilty. As to the second count of the information, Richard McGinnis, we the jury find the defendant, Kyle H. Rittenhouse, not guilty.
How do you feel, man? the jury reached the correct verdict. Self-defense is not illegal. And I believe they came to the correct verdict, and I'm glad that everything went well. And it's been a rough journey, but we made it through it. We made it through the hard part.
And now he'll be feted throughout right-wing, throughout the right-wing media sphere. Now, when you see people about going on about politicizing these things, keep that in mind. And then watch what the defense in the Ahmaud Arbery case. This is the case of a man jogging through a neighborhood in Georgia and being shot by a couple of guys who just felt like he shouldn't be there. Here is the defense attorney in that case. The politicization, this is what you talk about trying to politicize a trial. The idea that that somehow society is the existence of this guy's complaint in the past of black preachers who are interested in the case, on and on. Listen to this defense attorney.
This is what a public lynching looks like in the 21st century, with all due respect. They don't have to have 10,000 people outside. They don't have to have 100,000 people outside. Perception is reality. They haven't put a podium up outside with a hangman's noose on it. Doesn't mean that this isn't a trial, despite the best efforts of this court. This isn't a trial. It's been infected by mob violence of a woke left mob.
Remember, this is a story of a guy jogging. Just like literally going out for exercise jogging. Who was shot. And he, and this defense attorney is talking about mob violence that is being perpetrated metaphorically upon his clients. That's what how politicization works here. And all right, we got to take a quick break. Our guest today is really appropriate for the moment, actually. Professor William Blair. He is a professor of Middle American History at Penn State University. He's author of The Record of Murders and Outrages: Racial Violence and the Fight Over Truth at the Dawn of Reconstruction. We will explain as we talk about that the import for today. But first, a couple of words from our sponsors. Got a couple of sponsors today. Three, actually. This is a great gift, and I appreciate it more and more, frankly. It's StoryWorth. StoryWorth is an online service that helps you and your loved ones preserve precious memories and stories for years to come. Every week what happens is StoryWorth will email your relative or your friend, maybe your parents, cousins, whatever, and they email them a what is in many respects sort of like an innocuous question, but it's very thought-provoking. And you can choose those questions, or they can just send the default one. Each unique prompt asks questions that you'd never really thought to ask, like, what's the bravest thing you've ever done in your life? They'll say, like, you know, what was your favorite car? I mean, it just, and all these questions manage to push a couple of buttons in people's heads, and they bring about all sorts of stories. And after 1 year, StoryWorth compiles all of your loved one stories, include photos, into a beautiful keepsake book that you'll be able to share and revisit for generations to come. So it's one of those gifts that is like great for the getter, but also great for the giver. And then you end up using, you can get more books and you hand them out to, like, you give them as gifts to your siblings, if it's about your parents, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, it really is an amazing thing. And plus, it's a great way to stay in contact with people because you get to read their answers in real time as they build up. It is really, as you get older, like me, you start to realize the value and the, like, how much you don't know about your parents, You could do it for your kids, too, if they're little kids. I don't know. I mean, you could theoretically send it to yourself as a way of prompting you and forcing you to write about memories that you may not remember years from now. I mean, I don't know if anybody does that, but it actually occurs to me that maybe that's a gift I can give to my kids. Anyways, these are really great gifts. StoryWorth, you're giving those you love the most thoughtful and personal gift from the heart and preserving their memories and stories for years to come. Go to StoryWorth.com/majority. Save $10 on your first purchase. That's StoryWorth.com/majority. You will save $10 on your first purchase. It's a great, great holiday gift. Also, today's episode, sponsored by Honey. Everybody shops online. You've all seen that promo code field. If you're like me, you used to spend a lot of time finding those promos. But now you don't have to. Honey is a free browser extension. It scours the internet for promo codes, applies the best one, and then finds it to your cart. Honey supports over 30,000 stores online. Ranges from sites that have tech and gaming products to popular fashion brands, even food delivery. All right, here's how it goes. You're shopping on one of your favorite sites. You check out. The Honey button drops down. All you have to do is click apply coupons. You see it scroll through. Maybe it's scrolling through 3 or 4 or 6 different coupons to see if they work. Boom. They either find a coupon that works or they basically tell you, like, you're getting the cheapest price. That to me is almost as much value because I cannot stand to leave a couple of bucks on the table. Everybody knows that about me. Honey has found over 17 million members, over $2 billion in savings. I literally used to teach Mila, she wanted to shop for clothes or whatever it was, you got to check for the coupons. Then we added Honey, boom. She gets makeup. She saved a couple of bucks on makeup the other day. I saved, five, eight bucks on an air purifier. It's not bad. Completely free. And I didn't have to do any work. It just, boom. It was like, it's like almost like pulling like one of those, I don't know, those jackpot things. What are those called with the arms? The one arm bandits. Slot machine?
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Yeah, it's like a slot machine. Listen, if you don't already have Honey, you could be straight up missing out on free savings. It's literally free and it installs in a few seconds. And by getting it, you're going to be doing yourself a solid and you support the show. Get Honey for free at joinhoney.com/majority. That's joinhoney.com/majority. And lastly, you know your closet well, but what does it sound like? Yes, I'm talking about your closet. Does it sound like you? Does it whisper your taste? Does it scream your taste? With Stitch Fix Freestyle, a shop that evolves alongside your taste, your closet will scream very much you. Introducing Stitch Fix Freestyle. It is a shop that is built just for you. Stitch Fix Freestyle is your trusted style destination where you can discover and instantly buy curated items based upon your style, likes, and lifestyle. They sort of have one of those algorithms where you can sort of basically go in there into Stitch Fix, thumbs up, thumbs down on all types of different clothing, and it builds essentially a store based upon your likes. I also find that it goes a little bit outside there, too. So I find stuff that I never really contemplated that I would like. Doesn't matter if you're looking for a brand you love or you want to try a new one. At Stitch Fix Freestyle, you can shop a range of over 1,000 brands that are personalized to your size and to your fit. They have styles for workouts. They have styles for workwear, for lounging around the house, for a night on the town, all of it. Stitch Fix Freestyle has clothes for any occasion. Plus, there's no subscription required. And they offer free shipping, returns, and exchanges. Returns and exchanges with these guys are super, super easy. I bought a couple of things. I keep one. I send one back. Super easy. I have I forgot to check on what the brand is now. But I have here with me my baseball style zipper up cardigan, which maybe at one point I'll bring it on the show when we really get into the sweater thing. But it's a great piece. And it's a little bit of a push for me. I never contemplated a zip-up cardigan style, but I love it. You can get started today by filling out your style quiz at stitchfix.com/majority. That's stitchfix.com/majority. Try Stitch Fix Freestyle, stitchfix.com /majority. Folks, all of these links will be posted in our YouTube and in our podcast description. You can check them out there. And also stick around at the end of the show today because we have the first round of how far are you traveling to the live Majority Report show on January 16th. We will talk about that. But in the meantime, I want to welcome William Blair. He is a professor of Middle American History at Penn State University, author of The Record of Murders and Outrages, Racial Violence, and the Fight Over Truth at the Dawn of Reconstruction. Professor, welcome to the show.
I'm really glad to be here. Thank you.
So I have to say, like, when I first saw the title of your book, I thought, like, oh, he's doing a record of murders and outrages. But you are not doing the record of murder. Now, that was already done about 150 some odd years ago. Mm-hmm. And it is. So let's I want to talk about this in the broadest sense, as well as like some of the specifics. Let's just start with this. What is the Dunning School? Because so much of, as I've learned about Reconstruction, so much of it is submerged. As a kid, I learned nothing about this. Even in college, it was barely, it just seemed to be completely glossed over. Now, fair enough. I went to college 30 some odd years ago, and maybe part of it was a function of Dunning School that was, the things were sort of under, I don't know, represented. But what is the Dunning School?
It's historians who, William A. Dunning was the major architect of it. And it was a group of historians, mostly out of Columbia University, who did state-by-state studies of Reconstruction. They started in the 1890s, basically, and then continued on up, meaning when they were publishing, and they continued on up into the 20th century. And they left an incredible influence on how the public and academics even understood Reconstruction. And this was mainly a white perspective. Some of them were Southern, but, you know, Northerners as well. And they put on a spin on Reconstruction that it was a bad time, that very little was accomplished, that Black freedom was, voting was basically a joke that was forced upon the South, and that it was an overreach of governmental powers that was conducted. And in my case, they pretty much denied the reality of racial violence, especially how extensive it was.
I mean, this is having spent enough time like interviewing people from who study Reconstruction era and talking about, and we'll talk more about this obviously, and you have really sort of unearthed the catalog, as it were, but that's extraordinary. I mean, do we have like a sense of what the agenda was, or was this just sort of like poor history? I mean, characterize both what you think their agenda was, if there was one, and then let's talk about the implications of that and how long that those implications, you know, how durable they were.
Well, I believe they thought they were doing scientific history. They came along during the Progressive Era and during the rise of professional history, which really didn't get going until the 1880s or so. They were archival based, so they would go in and look at government reports in particular. But if you come up in this moment during a time of scientific racism, when the white academy believes firmly in the inequality of the races, you're going to see different things in the record than we do today. So in answering your question, I think they were actually being, they thought, objective and scientific, but they couldn't get beyond their racial blinders, and they would not accept some of the data that was just right in front of their faces. And as you say, they really endured until they began to fray until in the 1960s. There were a couple of people in the 1940s who were pushing back against a lot of their notions, but it really didn't get really displaced until the 60s and especially the 70s with brand new interpretations of Reconstruction. And then, of course, the magisterial book in 1988, which was a synthesis by Eric Foner that changed the way most people think about Reconstruction today.
I just like that. That concept is so extraordinary to me. I mean, because you think about the constitutional amendments that came out of Reconstruction, mm-hmm. basically provide, you know, the foundation of our modern society, at least in terms of, like, you know, when you look at, like, the Supreme Court and other, so much of what happens today is a function of Reconstruction, both its shortcomings and its successes. And I think in terms of the stories that it tells us, because, you know, right now we are dealing with a tremendous amount of, however you call it, fake news or misinformation, cross currents. People don't have faith in, and when one wonders what the relevance and what is problematic about this, all the answers are what are in the Dunning School and Reconstruction and your work. I mean, it really is, because the idea that this country operated, and I want to let you speak, but I'm just amazed by this. The idea that the country operated for 90 years, 80 years under the notion that none of this stuff happened during Reconstruction is stunning.
Well, let me just characterize one thing differently. They would admit that there was violence, but they just would not admit, one, the extent of it. They would say it was exaggerated. They would say it was just, frankly, what is normal, so to speak, in American life at that time, and that radical Republicans were blowing it up because they wanted to get the vote for African Americans so that it could enrich their own party. So they were not ducking the entire issue of violence, but they were diminishing it. And then secondly, they were just making it a conspiracy theory of radical Republicans. And that held true held true in the literature and the public mentality for a good long time, which is, frankly, one of the despicable parts about this project that I did, that it really angered me.
Talk more about what it was, just the complete misinterpretation?
The misinformation campaign, if you will, you know, the book talks about why this record of murders and outrages existed, which was because it was being denied, not just by the Dunning School later, but at the time by Democrats at that point. And so this was supposed to be the proof, by getting the Freedmen's Bureau to working with the freed people to collect data on the violence that was occurring. And it just was disheartening to me to see how, even when they brought this material up, even when they introduced it into Congress, even when they showed in 1868 how it was affecting elections in two states for the presidency, it was still being denied. And the fact is that it was being echoed in that denial for, as you put it, another 90 or more years. That was disheartening. It really was.
My producer just IM'd me and said, this is the real intellectual dark web in many respects. But let's go back. I mean, tell us, what was the Freedmen's Bureau? Or set the scene, I guess, where we have, Lincoln has obviously been assassinated. The radical Republicans have an agenda that they want to carry forward. Johnson is now the president. The Democrats don't want this agenda to go forward. They're trying to maintain as much white supremacy as you could politically in these southern states. What is the Freedmen's Bureau?
That was the first national welfare agency, if you will, if you want to think of it that way. They had the responsibility for helping Black Americans who had been enslaved to find their way to freedom. And to do that, they had a wide range of responsibilities: schooling, getting reaffirming marriages, churches, sometimes subsistence if people were starving, and things like that. Down the list at first, way down, was perhaps helping out with violence and law and order. But that grew as a responsibility only over the years. Just as they were on the ground seeing that there was a lot of violence happening around them. They being in all these southern communities, by the way. So out of 10 southern states, you have Freedmen's Bureau agents posted there. They're the arm of the military. So most of them are captains in the U.S. Army. And lo and behold, about after a year of seeing the violence, they just started collecting it. And with the help of higher ups like Ulysses S. Grant, who was the general in chief of the army, they started to try to make the case that law and order was not being preserved in the South. It was a very unequal situation, and black people faced little justice in the courts.
Give us a sense of the dynamic, like how, I mean, it almost seems like at one point the Freedmen's Bureau became almost like a spy agency is the wrong term, but on some level for the Republicans in the Senate who needed, I mean, this is the thing that I think is sort of really fascinating. And, you know, I don't want to stretch this too far, but, you know, over the past, obviously the big piece of legislation we're dealing with, in the country right now is the Build Back Better bill. Mm-hmm. And when the rating agencies came out and said, this is not going to impact inflation, it sort of created like at least a sense that maybe there was some pressure on Joe Manchin, who I don't think necessarily wanted to pass this bill anyways, but his public issue with it was sort of diffused in some way. I mean, that's the dynamic that was going on at that time, wasn't it? Obviously, the stakes of legislation are different, but they needed to make a rational argument, even though they knew that wasn't necessarily the motivation of their political opponents.
Well, what I liked was your surprise and marveling at the fact that the Freedmen's Bureau was operating in a way that maybe its founders weren't even, or wait, it's operating in a different way than you might want to think. Spy is, you're right, too strong, except I characterize it in the book that they were operating as an investigative arm of the Republicans in Congress. And that is pretty amazing when you think about it, because they, meaning the Freedmen's Bureau, is under the War Department. And the War Department is an executive office. So all of a sudden, what you started to see were congressmen, Republicans especially, who were using the Freedmen's Bureau kind of like their eyes and ears. Spy may be too strong, but they were using it as a data collector. And it was really fascinating because it really was breaching the usual constitutional channels that we have.
What was the legislation that they were, that, I mean, to the extent that, you know, the radical Republicans, you know, wanted this information, and I think they probably felt like it should just be out there broadly speaking, but what was their legislative agenda that this information was going to help promote or showed the need for?
Well, they wanted to take some incredibly important, huge steps in American history. They wanted to enforce black suffrage on the South when, frankly, it wasn't even in the North yet. There were five states in New England that did have African-American voting, but the broad swath of even Northern white people were not necessarily in favor of black suffrage. They also wanted to put the military back into the South and negate all the governments that had been established and have them start from scratch. And those governments were going to have to put into their constitutions black male suffrage again. So they were taking some pretty incredible steps. And the question is, how do you justify that? And how do you make it even constitutional? Because the Democrats were howling that this was, you know, not constitutional at all. It was an expansion of federal power that shouldn't have happened. Well, Article 4, Section 4 of the Constitution, it makes Congress have the responsibility to ensure Republican governments everywhere. That doesn't mean Republican Party governments. That means representative governments that practice equality before the law. And what they were able to do with this data, and they introduced it into Congress in February of 1867, they were able to say, look, fellas, A, it's not representative. They're not able to protect themselves or vote. B, there is no equal application of the law. Out of the data that they gathered, I think I showed in the book that out of roughly 3,000, almost 4,000 incident reports, and that meant maybe as many as 5,000 people, over a 3.5-year period, there were only 96 convictions. which is less than 1%, I think. I mean, it was just ludicrous. So if you have this data and you show the violence that's occurring, you can at least make the very strong case that, hey, we need to do some pretty hard stuff here. And you may not think it's constitutional, but we think it is because there's no equal application of the laws.
That clause, incidentally, came up on Friday on this program. We had a guest on it. About it as a potential mechanism for a Democratic Congress to help with the voting laws. And maybe even arguably things like gerrymandering, because there's a loss of a republic. I mean, we just today Georgia just passed, or at least in the Senate, the 2 million new voters, almost 100% of whom are minority voters, and they have created 64% of the delegation is going to be Republican, and there's no new seats that are going to be able to be won by a person of color. And so, this is ongoing. That is not even for those people who like the sticklers and say, we're not a democracy, we're a republic. We're not even at a republic at that point. And to be clear, that was the Military Reconstruction Act, right? The wholesale changes that they want to go in and basically remake these states, mm-hmm. which never came about.
Well, they did remake the states. All the states had to change their constitutions. What is disturbing to many of us, I know, is that the changes weren't permanent. It took another 10 years or so, but the South mounted what they called, the White South, excuse me, what they called redemption. I hate that term, but it's what they called it. And redemption meant anteing up the violence and even doing more in order to try to knock out Republican, and this time Republican Party governments, knock those out of the South and reinstitute white supremacy and Democratic machines. So they did succeed at first, but then there was a violent counter-revolution that came about.
So there really was almost two different waves of violence that we saw. Is that how to characterize? Will you describe those two different waves? And then let's talk about a couple of the incidents. I mean, you talk specifically in the book about stuff that happened in New Orleans and Louisiana and in Texas. Yeah. In particular, you singled those states out. I mean, obviously there was more, but talk about the two different waves and then let's get into some of the specifics.
Sure. Well, you can see violence at first, right after in Reconstruction, as being the early product of we don't want to see changes happening, meaning you'd have local fights at the plantation level over even children. I never thought about how rape under slavery creates families, and then when you start to pull those families apart, who gets the children? So there was violence over that. There was violence over labor arrangements. There was violence that was, more spontaneous, perhaps, maybe not as planned. But by the time you hit 1867 and you get the Reconstruction Acts, you start to see a very much guerrilla kind of warfare that erupts deliberately to affect political change. By the time you hit 1868, that's when you see the Klan at its most efficient, so to speak, and really using terrorism to try to keep Black Americans away from the polls and white unionists who were voting with them, anybody who's a Republican Party member. And one of the things you can see in these the records of murders and outrages is just that rise of the Klan and how it starts to affect political change. Two states, Georgia and Louisiana, had a registered Republican Party majority for the presidential election. Somehow, the Democrats, they voted Democrat. Well, again, the record showed the terrorism that was employed that kept Black people from the polls. So then after this, the Klan was actually basically dissipated by 1870 and 71 in action by the federal government that passed the Klan Acts and went in and tried to ferret it out, especially in the Carolinas. But then by that point, really the federal government was eroding in its interest, I should put it that way. in the South because there were more problems popping up in the North. The South looked like it had been reconstructed, meaning all the governments had been put back in. And that's when you started to see that awful word redemption occur, when white terrorists would, without being Klan-based now, but just organizing themselves in things called rifle clubs and other kind of white supremacist groups. That's when they used violence, intimidation, guns, and so on to try to keep Black Americans from the polls. And they eventually took over all of the governments in the South.
Let's talk about that first wave a little bit more. You provide three different tables in your in your book, and I'm not sure why this was the case for me, but you have one table of from 65 to 68 of basically all the incident reports, murder, mm-hmm. physical assaults, verbal assaults. This is collected, we should say, by the Freedmen Bureau. And transmitted ostensibly to the Republicans in the Senate at that time, mm-hmm. And you look at the raw numbers, like murders, and it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 states or so, 1,600, and I was like, wow, 1,600 murders over the course of 3 years in 9 states. But then you look at like the number of people who actually vote in these states, and you realize like. Things were a lot smaller at that point. Like this is a lot of this is a lot of stuff going on, and it was not haphazard at all. These were all of, in many respects, like political acts of violence.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely, especially when you get to 1868, and one of the massacres that is in the book that is known in Louisiana and with some state historians, but really is not in the literature of Reconstruction, was deliberately political terrorism. It occurred in Bossier Parish and Cato Parish, Louisiana, beginning in late September, early October. And over the course of a few weeks, probably at least somewhere near 200 African-Americans were gunned down. The two counties had something like a 4,000 some odd registered voters Black. Two Black people voted in the presidential election. That's an eye opener. It was a real attempt to chill the voting at the polls, and it worked at that point.
So 4,000 voters, 200 people killed over the course of a couple of weeks, gunned down. And absolutely no accounting for this, right? I mean, it was barely even reported at the time.
It was barely reported at the time. Frankly, I have little confidence that we would know as much as we do about it were it not for the federal government. The Freedmen's Bureau were the first to report it. But I give the government some credit. Congress then conducted investigations because I really wanted to find, well, it's sort of self-serving, I should say, too, because I wanted to know, well, how the heck did we lose Louisiana when we had a registered majority? But they started to hold investigations. They had witnesses who would come up and actually testify. There were big, thick documents on this. And so, thankfully, we do have a record of what happened. And it's really ugly. There were mass executions. People taken to the river in chains and shot down. I think I just want to stop there because I still get disturbed thinking about it.
Let's talk about, and that's at Red River, right? I mean, let's talk about Texas. Because in 1866, we have sort of similar dynamics that are brewing. And, What did we see in Texas in terms of and we should say, and then maybe we'll move to Memphis too. These are the lesser known lesser known massacres. I mean, I feel like we're just now as a society starting to reckon with what happened in Wilmington and what happened in North Carolina and South Carolina and this is sort of almost like. Even more obscured in Oklahoma, more obscured.
No, you're absolutely right. In Texas was shocking to me. I'd never realized We were the ones who did the tabulation. Every Freedmen's Bureau reports, we had to comb through it for a couple of years to put the tallying together. And when we sat down and all of a sudden saw that Texas accounted for, I forget, almost 60% of all the known terrorism that occurred, it was just mind-blowing. I start the one chapter out talking about how Sheridan, the general who was in charge there, said that if he owned Texas in hell, he would live in hell and rent out Texas because it was just that violent. What you had there, too, was a power struggle that was going on between two white factions. And they were both one of them was trying to use black voting and the other one was trying to deny it. And those factions that had actually existed even before the war continued through the war. And then it was just a hotbed of violence. And Texas seems to have had a violent history, even in the antebellum period, that was beyond the pale of most of the states, I should say. And all that happened was after the war, you took natural violent culture, you stirred the political waters up, you heated it up, and all of a sudden it just boiled over like crazy. Had the most number of incident reports of any by far.
Where does, tell us about Memphis.
Memphis is a really well-known massacre, frankly. It's part of the canon of Reconstruction literature, as well as the New Orleans massacre. They did captivate the country in 1866 in May and July, I think, if I'm remembering correctly, or June. Don't hold me to that. But it was in 1866. Those two, because they were city-based, urban, they had newspaper reporters. They had people there, and it became widely disseminated, almost like our current situations when we have these murders of Black Americans today. So everybody knew about these. In Memphis, it was actually mustering out former Union Black soldiers who angered the white community there because they looked too independent. And it caused a repercussion where people started to come in and started to shoot Black people down. Killed 40-some-odd, raped maybe about five African-American women, and it made big headlines and even a congressional investigation across the North. That much has been well-known, but the Bossier massacre that I mentioned is only in regional studies. And in fact, in couple of our really good big time newspapers, they don't even mention it as one of the massacres that occurred during Reconstruction. So you're right. We are still unearthing a lot of what happened.
And how, I mean, is there any way to measure? I mean, I can't imagine that there is, because it's not like, you know, people are being polling or being polled necessarily but I mean, I'm just trying to sort of like, I remember when in the wake of 9/11, I think it was, we had there were snipers. There was a sniper team essentially in Washington, D.C. And I just remember like the impact of that, you know, in terms of like what it did for people's behavior and whatnot. I don't know that we have a. I think it's hard for people in modern day, even when we see like the implications of the way that police interact with black people. And I think black people, you know, have a whole set of ways in which they talk to their kids about police and this and that. We can see the implications of those acts of violence. But the idea of 100 people or 200 people being shot down over the course of 10 days, we can see it in, out of 4,000 people, only two people be willing to go and vote. But is there any other sort of like indication? And maybe, I guess, in Wilmington, you had people like basically leave town and hide out. But do we have any other ways of marking the efficacy of this type of political terrorism and what it did to these communities of black people for how long?
You can attack some of it by voting records, but stunningly, when I looked at some of the, you know, I have a very abbreviated period. I end my study in 1868. Even in Texas, still about 80% of black people turned out to vote, who were eligible to vote down in Texas, which I find remarkable, faced with what they were looking at with all the violence. It was actually one of the claims by the naysayers that said this violence couldn't be happening. They said people were staying put and weren't leaving as much as they expected. They said, hey, if the violence was so bad, they'd be dispersing to the winds and leaving. But that's a hard thing to do when you're poor and you have to pay for a move and you have no community you know you're going to be welcomed in. Your question, though, gets at a root of something that is really befuddling, and I wish I had answers for, because in this case, historians have very poor methodology for finding trauma and figuring out what is the impact of trauma. I thought about that almost every day I was doing this project, that here are people who are marked and scarred by a terrible event. It had to leave a bad imprint, but I don't have records to be able to even say, what did it do? How did it affect them? And it's one of the untold parts of this project that sometimes, frankly, tears me up.
It also has to be, I mean, I imagine that working with this material as you have, I mean, really in one form or another for a couple of decades now, at least, I imagine, do you have a vision of an alternate reality that takes place during that time in Reconstruction? I mean, it just seems like such a hard thing not to speculate about. Like, what if, I don't know, I mean, you know, Johnson's not Johnson. If the radical Republicans had, I don't know, half a dozen more votes in the Senate, or, yeah. I mean, like, what does that look like for you?
Well, I actually wrote a piece about it a long time ago in what it's called Civil War History, one of the scholarly journals. And we had a panel that talked about what if, you know, how would Reconstruction change? And my part of it, in my essay I wrote, basically said we needed military occupation far stronger than what we had, far more soldiers, and for far, far longer a period of time. Our occupation of the South, which dwindled considerably by 1870s, did last, though, until 1877. So what does that work out to, like 12 years of occupation? And I was speculating it was going to take much more muscle, maybe for another 20, 30 years, to have made an indelible difference against white supremacy in the South and would have changed the story. The American appetite for that? It just wasn't there. There was no political will to do that. Think of how long we were in Afghanistan, not even anywhere near as long, and we eventually lost the political will there to stay.
What accounts, though, for the... I mean, it's one thing to have not had the political influence and the outcomes on the South that we would have liked. But what accounts for the, not just the failure to impose a better situation or system or to protect black people, but the massive success of the South to rewrite history and have it be so durable, right? And on some level, we're just seeing that reckoning now with the tearing down of these statues. It seems to me is really the first time that our society is beginning to sort of, even if it's almost more visceral than it is an intellectual exercise, to realize like something was revised about the reality that took place.
And we're back full circle to the Dunning School, aren't we? What started to happen around the turn of the 20th century was things like the Dunning School, movies like Birth of a Nation, and a whole genre of both history and pseudo-history that began to try to reforge good feelings between North and South. One of the things that happened was the erection of, this always blows me away, by 1914, the largest monument in Arlington National Cemetery, our National Cemetery for the United States, the largest monument there and still is the Confederate monument that was put up in 1914. It's 30 feet high. So there was a process going on where white people reached across the chasm, the bloody chasm, as it was called, and they were trying to reforge reunion. And, of course, racism factors into this.
Let me ask you one thing that's not actually part of the book, but it was in one of the interviews that I read that you did, because I found this also fascinating. And this is a big question that that we talked about on Friday, actually, too, with the Jamelle Bouie. It was a letter written by Charles Blackford in to talk about strategy for the 1889 state elections. I suspect that you know what I'm talking. Oh, yeah. But let me quote it, because I don't know, unless you've memorized it. But it really is stunning. Blackford is, and this goes, we should say, this speaks to the question of how racism was utilized, developed. I mean, I'm sure we could find this dynamic 100 years prior to this, maybe even 150 years prior to this, in this country. But it is an indicative of how racism is used by essentially capitalists. He goes on to say, the Negroes must understand we will give them perfect equality before the law and treat them with justice and fairness and liberality. But that they're not to rule us. In other words, we're not going to give you really any of those things. That we will die before they shall do so. The election must be carried peaceable if we can, but by force if necessary. And then this is actually you saying, then he showed Democratic elites calculating how to break the white-black coalition that had fueled the readjuster movement. This is the coalition between, I guess, sort of like what would ultimately be the populist party and maybe populist and white workers union.
So it was a black-white biracial coalition that actually succeeded in Virginia and scared much of the rest of the South.
And so he said, you cannot keep the lower class of white men in line unless they distinctly understand that they are to make their selection between the Negro on one side and the white race on the other. Once get that clearly before the people as an issue, and we are safe. Otherwise, the tariff and other matters, which are perfectly immaterial in comparison, will beat us. Just for people don't fully grasp what's going on there, will you just tease that out for us?
Well, sure. I mean, again, they had seen black and white people vote together, and they did things. It was called, why it's called readjusters is because the debt load was heavy, and a lot of the poor people couldn't pay their debts, and they would get into prison and other trouble. So a white-black coalition formed and put into office both as governor and then U.S. Senator. William Mahone, was a Republican, basically, and that scared the Democratic South, and they needed to break that up. And you can use violence, and that was one of the means, but you can also use racism. And that is what they were trying to do, trying to make sure that white did not vote with black. But the third thing you can use is Confederate tradition. Jubal Early gave a speech, not at that exact same time, but nearly, where he addressed veterans. And one of the things they were very aware of was that the Civil War was not always popular with everybody, that there were deserters. And Jubal Early said in a Memorial Day speech, it's okay if you deserted then, just don't desert us now. We want you to vote the right way. So trying to bring even former soldiers back into the fold using Confederate traditions in that way. But the big fear, and there was a little bit of that same kind of movement in South Carolina. And the big fear was that you just can't have white and black people voting in the same direction.
And how successful was Blackford?
They eventually won. But it took a while. One of the things that it is kind of interesting is just how long black voting did stay. It persisted until we finally started to get the Jim Crow laws that started in the 1890 in Mississippi and then unfolding throughout the next decade. So they used the law, they used massacres, they used the Wilmington Massacre in 1898, and all of that was to achieve white supremacy.
What does all of this, what does this this dynamic that we've been talking about, what is it, what is the lesson for us today? I mean, on some level, like, you know, in terms of how early history starts to get written, I guess.
Well, it was getting written just during that time period. In fact, in 1866, a guy by the name of Pollard, who was a newspaper editor, published a book called The Lost Cause. And that's what has stuck the name on to that movement of denial about the Confederacy and what it fought for. So it happens pretty darn quickly, almost like you see, frankly, today, spin doctors putting new. How do you interpret and create a narrative of what just happened, like in January 6th, for example? On the one hand, I see it as a insurrection. Not everybody does, I guess. There are others who try to spin a different tale, that these are patriots trying to do their thing. So you see that happening in the Civil War just about by a year after, and it just picks up momentum as you go through the late 19th century. And then you add historians like the Dunning School, and then you add popular culture, and it becomes embedded in our DNA in ways that are really hard to tear apart right now.
And obscures dynamics that are going on 150 years later.
Absolutely. We're still unraveling that past.
William Blair, professor of Middle American History at Penn State, author of The Record of Murders and Outrages, Racial Violence and the Fight Over Truth at the Dawn of Reconstruction. We will put a link to that at majority.fm. Can't thank you enough for taking the time with us today.
It was a real pleasure, and I can't thank you enough.
All right, folks. There it is.
Racial violence at the dawn of reconciliation, huh? Talking about the Build Back Better bill?
Almost went there. Almost went there. Yeah, just a little bit, a little frazzled today, folks.
Do you think the reason Kyle Rittenhouse is so welcomed by a society that was in part won by racialized terrorism, that realized it might require racialized terrorism to maintain that? But
I mean, honestly, I don't think there's that level. Well, I mean, who knows? Maybe there's that level of intellectual understanding behind it. But I think it's also just sort of, I mean, when people say, like, why do you spend so much time on pushing back on conservative narratives and whatnot? And I don't want people to misinterpret that that we think that we have. A particular level of influence, but it's just as an exercise, but also, butterfly wings. I don't know how the interpretation of what Kyle Rittenhouse did will impact our history in 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, or our future, I should say. But we certainly have examples from Reconstruction and so on, and like putting up those statues in the 1920s as to what it does to our present day. Mm-hmm. Like, we can't know. That's what you begin to understand when you talk to a historian like that, the implication of journalism, of narrative building, of all those things in the moment. And who knows what any given one of those events in the reporting, if it would have had, what kind of influence it would have had. We you can't really sort of like disentangle all those things, but largely it is the lesson is, it's important to make sure that events that are happening are interpreted and are reported in a way that is that is not a lie, because that lie can actually have a lot more durability and impact than you probably anticipate in the moment.
Yeah, and I made that dark web message because you talk about all these people posing as the seekers of unvarnished truth. And if you historicize this at all, the idea that wokeness is the obstacle to truth and not like capitalists using racism and the effect that's had on just our understanding of our place in the world just for generations is, I think, stunning and never even touched at by, like, of course, the IDW folks.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is why, you know, things like January 6th, the commission on January 6th is so important. And this is why people push back on it so much. This is why people push back on it so much, because they don't want this narrative to be out there. That, understand, the, you know, there are reasons why the online community and off the online community, but there's reason why people fight this stuff out on Twitter, and whether they're conscious of it or not, you gotta suppress this stuff or magnify and enhance this stuff in the moment, because that's where the trajectory starts. I mean, that's, you know, can you imagine what would the difference have been if YouTube existed during Reconstruction?
I mean, yeah, like, we live in a country where, like, in the 1830s, 20s, there's legislation punishing people for teaching slaves to read, right? And we live in, like, this is new, these revisions of history, like he's talking about, that's like the 70s, right? But even then, you have new information technology that makes it easier to spread this stuff. So that's why you have the PC freakouts to this critical race theory freak out.
That's an important point that people should understand. You know, if it is only because of, like, people's work, you know, like Foner and others in the 70s and late 60s and the 70s, that we have access to this information now and this understanding of our history. And our understanding of, like, why were all these Confederate statues all over the place? And why were they put up in 1920? So, you know, 50 years after the war. And the reason why you're seeing such pushback to critical race theory, and it's obviously not critical race theory that's being taught there, but there is sort of you may get you know, more history, more explicit history, maybe history of Reconstruction in some of these schools, but also just a, you know, an awareness of the dynamic that's going on in these countries. I would love it if they teach critical race theory in schools or some derivation, and maybe they will. But the reason why there's a pushback on it is, again, for the same reason. You need to obscure the dynamics that are going on in our society. And that's that. Folks, oh, I promised you. We have a couple contenders. Bradley, you're going to have to set up a spreadsheet, and we'll input this. I'm going to put this on your desk because people probably can figure it out. But I've told people, email us at majorityreporters@gmail.com and put in the subject line, distance to the live show. As you know, we're doing a live show to commemorate January 16th in Boston, Mass. At 3 p.m.
Big Live.
The Big Live, as we call it. You can get your tickets at majoritylive.com or majorityreportlive.com. And we have people traveling from some pretty significant distances. Send us an email, subject line, distance to live show. Hi, everyone. My submissions to the farthest traveler. I'm going to the show from State College, Pennsylvania. That's Kyle. State College is in the middle of nowhere. It's not easy to get there. You get down, like, what is it, Route 86? It's 86 or 80. 80 is the big turnpike there, I think. But Sandy of Left of the Box says she's going to be traveling from the live show from Waterloo, Ontario, Canada. She's driving solo. It's a 9-hour drive. She's having to deal with her passport. Hey, guys, as per show rules, I'm writing to you on direct order of Sam Cedar a few years ago. It's at the top of the now famous Door Cedar funnel you folks have constructed. Started listening to the show. Really tough time for me personally. Found you guys through a slew of recommended videos alongside the Jimmy Dore, TYT, and Joe Rogan. Since then, I've been a daily viewer of the show. College, marriage, job, family, buying first home, all since the time that I started listening. That's fantastic. Alex Jones listener, Glenn Beck fan before discovering Demijor and then getting to the Majority Report. And coming from the live show, he didn't say where from. Oh, darn it. Well, all right. He's not in the running. I'm from Winnipeg, staying in Toronto, and I will be attending the live show, says Andy. And then Kate, she brings the hammer down, traveling from L.A.
Wow.
And then Gabe from, I'm not sure where, I'm going to guess Canada. Google says 930 kilometers. That is not... Nice try.
That guy sneaked one past us.
Yeah, that is kilometers instead of miles. That's not going to cut it. Don't write in and tell me how many inches it is. Or centimeters, for that matter. You're going to come in with mileage. But send us your emails. Majority Live, if you want to join us. And enter the competition. I don't know what you're going to get. Maybe we'll like some swag or something for the top three furthest travelers. That seems fair. All right. We're going to take a break. Head into the fun half of the program. Don't forget, it's your support that makes this so possible. Oh, let me just say this, too. I don't know about what's happening with tomorrow. Emma may be here solo. I don't want to come in and this is like 1% doctrine territory because of folks traveling. So if for whatever reason, maybe I would call in or something for a little bit, but if for whatever reason, I am not here tomorrow, I want to wish everybody, and Wednesday we're going to have a pre-recorded interview. Check it out. Great one on the post office. But if for whatever reason I am not here tomorrow because of this little COVID scare, everybody's healthy. I don't think it's going to be an issue, but safe, better safe than other people being sorry, in my opinion. Have a great Thanksgiving and safe travels. And we will see you soon. We'll have all new material, though, the whole week except for Thursday. We're going to take Thursday off. Don't forget, you can support this show by becoming a member. Join themajorityreport.com. And don't forget, justcoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY, get 10% off. And not only is Sunset Lake Zabade doing a massive sale, 30 to 60% off, they are donating proceeds, 10% of the proceeds from everything they sell between now and December 1st, 10%. We'll go towards donating to Give Directly. We will match at the Majority Report. We're going to match that 10%. So great deals to be had there and doing some good. So check that out as well. Matt, what's happening in the Matt Lekian media universe?
Yeah, if you wanted to watch Christopher Hitchens and Whoopi Goldberg debate Bill Maher, Dennis Prager, and Gene Simmons of KISS about communism, well, patreon.com/leftreckoning. We did just that this weekend. David and I talk about a very amazing politically incorrect segment where Bill Maher tells Whoopi Goldberg that her family that died in Vietnam weren't wasted lives, because sometimes wasted lives are unwasted lives because you prove your enemies how tough you are. So pretty classic Bill Maher stuff. So patreon.com/leftreckoning for that. And also we got a talk with Lillian Tchurchia on Wednesday for folks.
All right, folks. See you in the fun half. Left is best. G. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous? You're a little bit upset? You're riled up?
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude.
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 You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2, 5/8, 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd.
Don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh. Rand Paul.
I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agree.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
But Sam, I gotta get off.
No worries. Let's I wanna just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me.
Hey, shut up!
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.